from an early age you're told you can't do this, you can't do that, then that type of mindset that we just discussed is not like an ideal, you know, mindset. It's not even feasible, because you've been shown that that's not going to work out for you. Don't even think like that. Oh, you could never get that opportunity. You can't drive a car like that. I mean, that's a materialistic view, but it's just like goals that are attainable, you know, don't even set for yourself, you know? And I think that having a visual representation, and even more so having a personal connection to someone that is a representation of that, like, just shows like, yeah, you can do that.
This is the Beware How
Show.
Mystic philosophy made practical. I'm Bob, speaking weekly with Scott and Ryan. We're three conscious creatives and formerly closeted mystics trying to unpack the inaccessible. According to the mystics, the truth cannot be spoken, but we'll try to talk about it anyway.
Today is Sunday, August 2nd, and our guest today is Jason Ivey. What's up, Jason? Thank you for joining us.
What's up? What's up? How's everyone doing? What's up, Bob, Scott, Ryan? How are y'all?
Very good. Good to
doing
see you.
Good.
Doing up, great. I'm going to read your very impressive long bio, and then we'll jump right in.
Dope.
Jason Ivey is an award-winning singer, songwriter, music producer, film producer, and entrepreneur from the South Side of Chicago. Since officially starting his career in 2018 with the release of his first project, Jason has been consistently recognized by Reverb Nation as one of the top 40 artists in R&B. He's been featured in publications and films from Billboard, Next Showcase, USA, Chicago Music Guide, and Self Magazine. In 2019, Jason won the John Lennon Songwriting Contest as a finalist for R&B. He has a bachelor's degree in cognitive neuroscience and linguistics from the University of Pennsylvania, a bachelor's in biology from the University of Chicago, and international relations from the University of Cambridge. He's worked with NASA. And aside from the creative arts, Jason develops social emotional learning technology for students and is a strong advocate for underserved and underrepresented communities.
Awesome.
That is super impressive. excited to jump in and unpack that. You know, I have a few questions for you, obviously related to, you know, all this different work you're doing. But first, tell us about yourself. Tell us about your background, kind of personal, you know, early professional, and just growing up. I know you're young, but you're already going.
Yeah. I mean, I've been moving and shaking since I was a kid. I mean, my parents taught me early, you know, the value of working on yourself, improving yourself, and just kind of absorbing everything around you. So then by the time that I was two, you know, I could already read, write, speak, and then I was writing in cursive. And I mean, this stuff wasn't like fun for me then. It was just kind of, this is what you have to do, and this is, you know, going to be part of your life going forward. So, you know, they were homeschooling me since I was able to, you know, pick myself up on 2 feet. And then I started first grade at 3, and I tested, I think, fifth grade, sixth grade at that time. So, you know, I kept going through school and they kept testing me. And by the time I was in fifth and sixth grade, I was testing college level for a lot of things. And they were, you know, deciding if they were going to skip me all the way ahead or just let me progress as a normal kid. And my mom made the call that, you know, after skipping 2 grades already, I wouldn't be skipping anymore because she didn't want me to be emotionally, you know, stunted in terms of my peers and other kids my age. And, you know what kids are into.
Sure, yeah.
they can be kind of wild.
You just blow past everyone else. She was smart to mitigate
exactly.
That. Yeah.
I think so. I was a little bit spiteful at the time because I was like, you know what, I could have had less school, you know, less time in school. That would have been great for me as a kid, but looking back, I'm like, you know, I'm glad, because going to college at 16 was already, you know, kind of a hurdle in and of itself, especially being completely away from family in Chicago. I was on the East Coast for the first time, and just on my own. And honestly, I wanted to get even further. As you mentioned, like my background in Cambridge, I wanted to go over there for my first degree, but no, Philly was far enough. So yeah, I mean, getting to college was kind of like a testing ground for a lot of the things that I wanted to continue to do. And music was one of them. The sciences are one of them. And I mean, I was just inspired by the sciences early on because my mom was a breast cancer survivor. You know, I started out at UChicago studying cancer bio and trying to understand all of that because, you know, that happened when I was a kid. I was like 8 or 9 when she was diagnosed. And, you know, you look at a word like that and you're like, what does this mean? How does this mean? You know, how's my life going to change after this? So taking a course seemed like the perfect thing since, you know, academics have been drilled into me since an early age. I'm like, maybe I can understand it this way. I got to Penn and I decided, you know, that's not what I want to study for the rest of my time here. Cancer bio is enough at UChicago. But maybe understanding the way people work would be a way to go. So I went with neuroscience after, like, I think I declared it like my junior year, maybe senior year, after taking a bunch of different courses. And yeah, the rest was history. You know, music was always there though.
Yeah, very cool. Appreciate that background. I didn't mention it in the bio. It's not, frankly, it's not in your bio. You and I kind of co-wrote together. You sent me something, I added to it, but, you know, yeah, the being passing everyone in school, at a super early age is a big part of the story. And, you know, I guess just to kind of follow up about that aspect, you know, like what's the secret? I mean, obviously you probably have a natural gift that's just, you know, that's undescribable, but like, I got a 6-month-old, like, what should we be going through some study guides? Like what?
Oh yeah. I would say, you know, my parents would play tapes for me when I was asleep. That was back when, you know, you would have a physical radio and you can like put in a tape and press play and then restart it several hours later. But I think that it's even easier in this really increasingly digital age, you know, just go to a YouTube page and be like, oh, Spanish 4 hours long introduction, cool, play that while the kid's sleeping. And I think that stuff like that, the subliminal intake, actually does work a great deal, because I mean, I kind of taught myself German that way. In college I would just play like 2-3 hour long loops and just in my sleep, and sometimes I wake up, you know, thinking in German and not knowing exactly what I'm thinking, which is a scary place to be. But I'm like, what was that sentence in my head? I just go look it up. I think that's the way to go. And my dad also like wrote books for me when I was a kid, so he'd just like write stories and put like my name into the story. And I think that that's another thing that helps kids to understand better, just placing themselves in the story from the beginning.
That's interesting you say that. I just read, there was just a conference that we attended, our team virtually obviously, but they were talking about the power of stories over like regurgitating information. We retain, you know, a very small percentage. I'm not going to make up the number because I don't remember, but it was like a super small percentage of, you know, actual regurgitation of facts versus like stories. Exactly. We remember, you know, yeah. It was like 70 or 80% of what, a, you know, when you break it down that way. And that's probably because of oral tradition, you know, thousands of years of human civilization. We didn't have writing, so we use stories to communicate ideas. But yeah, no, I'm glad you shared that because yeah, I'm taking notes. And yeah.
Take notes, Bob.
Absolutely.
I mean, maybe another note for child development would be to teach your child ASL early, or baby sign, I guess they call it, for that developmental age, because, you know, the vocal cords are still forming. And this comes from my linguistics background, but, you know, they're still forming. Babies babble for, you know, a number of months, up to almost 2 years. But your hands are very dexterous from the time that you're born. And that comes from, like, I guess, a primitive background. You know, if you put a rope in a baby's hand and ask it to hang on something, it's going to hang on it. And that's just off of reflex. So, you know, that the ability to form those complicated signs are there. And then, you know, the thought processes are there. And you just have to combine those into kind of develop those language learning centers in the brain. And that'll be the foundation for speaking multiple languages, you know, early on. You have until like 6 years old to learn as many languages as you can before that just falls off rapidly in the brain. And then it's kind of just hard work from there. So early on.
Yeah. That is fascinating. I remember reading about there being like a, I guess it was like a theory in anthropology or like early civilization that like verbal speech maybe grew out of like the dexterity of our hands, because it like the subtlety of our fingers helped develop parts of the brain that then were used for, you know, tongues and lips and stuff like yeah. that. So that's
I believe that's that. That sounds cool. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah.
Nice.
That's cool. You were also kind of using your hands to illustrate your
I know. I do it a lot. I'm always like crab clawing when I talk. That's just a thing I do.
Yeah. That's great.
It's proof.
Awesome. Well, yeah, Jason, I'm going to be following up with you on a bi-monthly basis here as my child grows to That's check easy. In with you. And I'm sure you're also, you know, you're developing social emotional learning technology, which we'll get in, I think, later on in this episode, but so we'll circle back there. Okay. I like cool. how you are able to talk about like, oh well, from my neuroscience background or like from my linguistics background, you can cite just all these different avenues in which you've studied. You know, tell us more about that. Like I read something about Elon Musk and how he's probably the most famous polymath, right? If, you know, that's the term that we're,
probably.
We're going over here, you know, PayPal, SpaceX, and Tesla, obviously.
Neuralink, all that.
He's pretty busy, and he gets asked that question a lot of, like, how do you become an expert in so many subjects, you know? Yeah, when you went to college, you started realizing, wow, I'm interested in this. Wow, I'm interested in this. Well, you knew that earlier, probably, but it formed more fully even in university for you to say, hey, there's all these different avenues to follow. Like, tell us more about that, either... you know, kind of decision-making yeah. process to pursue another thing, or, you know, how do you codify all of it?
I think that for a lot of individuals who are more socially inclined, and I would consider myself an extrovert, that a large percentage of the things that we do are compartmentalized, and that just kind of makes it easier to be like, okay, I'm going to a party, like this is my mindset, or I'm going to the grocery store during COVID, I have a completely different mindset than a party. And I probably shouldn't even be mentioning parties right now. but like,
I remember
that's just kind of like, yeah, those old things. I don't know if they're extinct now or what. But
yeah,
it's just like being able to code switch, I think we would call it, and just switch lanes just like that. I don't know, from early on, you know, even back in like high school or maybe seventh and eighth grade, I had a hard time doing well when it came to social endeavors if it wasn't a cool thing, you know, if it was just one or two things, I'm just like, okay, I wouldn't give myself any time to do it because I'm like, I have time to do this later, I can just, it's just one thing, I can just, you know, put it off till, you know, I don't have any more time, I'll procrastinate, I guess is the word. But as I took on more and more things, it made me focus more, you know, so I guess I was more focused with 12 things on my plate than one or two. And I'm not sure how that logic works, but, you know, I'm like, okay, now I have to divide my time, you know, and prioritize and use all these time management skills that people talk so much about, because I'm forcing myself to. And I think that's a way for me to hold myself accountable, instead of just succumbing to, oh, yeah, I've got time to do this later. And then, oh, the assignment's late. Oh, I did this to myself, you know? Yeah.
Sure. So the motivation of like the higher expectation and like the higher need and higher drive kind of creates an inertia almost that carries you forward more so that stagnation and, you know, lack of stimuli might not do. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
That's not how most people work, but conceptually, I understand that.
I don't know. I think it comes from a place also to, you know, continue that drive that was instilled in me early on, just, you know, if there's something out there that I don't understand much about and someone, you know, brings it up in conversation and I'm like, oh, interesting, you know, then I switch into a completely different mode. I'm like, all right, now I'm listening, you know, proactively. And when I get a second, I'm going to go home and just like open 30 tabs about that and read on it until I get extremely bored and, you know, or I think that I understand it and, or I found another avenue that I want to travel down. Yeah, I don't know. Super cool. It's just always been an insatiable need for me.
Yeah, there's a joy
Master
in that.
Of the deep dive on the internet.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Those hour long computers almost dead deep dives.
Yeah.
Nice. Hey, Bob, I'm wondering if you could define polymath, because I don't know if I even know the definition of a polymath.
Sorry. Yeah, I should have done that. That just means a wide range of knowledge across many subjects.
Cool. Nice.
You know, Da Vinci is probably the most famous of all time historically. Artist, writer, inventor,
yeah,
sketch, so on. You know,
the Renaissance. You tend to see that cross between the arts and the sciences, which I always love that interplay too, because I grew up with two parents in the sciences, and then they had me and my brother who both went into the arts, and like we both, you know, we love both, and it's like, yeah, I find myself alternating between like music and programming, which is like seems counterintuitive, but I don't, it feels right to me, so it's like,
oh yeah. I wonder if you could like code a program to like write music for you. That'd be dope.
Yeah, well, I'm sure people have tried, and like I'm sure that exists, and that's actually what got me into it. Is I wanted to take some music and like try to create a music experience programmatically, where like it, you know, it's taking into account like, you know, phone or, you know, like whatever device movements and stuff. But yeah, it's like there's a lot of interplay, of course. Where it gets interesting to me is the cross-pollination between subjects. It's like that's when new stuff gets invented and like new ideas are had, is when you're sharing between these seemingly separate subjects, but that are actually very, very related.
Very related at the core. Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell us about your music project.
Yeah, it's amazing. I loved that. The music you sent me was incredible. Or sent us. Incredible.
Thank you.
I was really enjoying it.
It's really good. I'm excited for it to get published and put on Spotify so I can add it to playlists.
Yeah.
I'm waiting for that too, because I can only hear it on SoundCloud, and I'm like racking up all these plays to myself that aren't going to count down the line.
Exactly. Right. Tell us about the output. I know you put out early stuff a couple years ago, and now this is, I know you're like sitting on, I think, two LPs right now, or what?
Are you at now? So I'm sitting on two LPs currently. They're both 10 songs in length. And then earlier I released two EPs. One was 6 songs long and the other one was just 2 songs. It was just, you know, something I had on my hard drive, and I was like, oh yeah, like I can drop this today because Bandcamp is doing a promotion. So I dropped it, and people were like, oh, you dropped music? Like even to like yesterday or today, you know, people were like, oh, I didn't even know you dropped another project. And I'm like, it wasn't really, you know, marketed or advertised. It was just to get it out there and off my computer. But the ones that I am sitting on, I'm looking heavily forward to. I think that they'll be, you know, defining projects for me, just because one, I've never dropped an album, and I've worked on Thanius 2019. So it's just like, I put 99 studio hours into these projects. I wrote all the lyrics myself. I had featured artists that are, you know, just unbelievably talented. Like this one woman named Shuba, she went to the University of Chicago. She's from Michigan. Now out in LA, and I mean, just recently is being finally recognized for her talent on TikTok. She hit 1 million followers, and you know, publications all over LA are like writing about her because she was doing different covers of songs, like spot on covers. And I think that the ideal thing would be for those people that, you know, she was covering to hear, you know, she did like Megan Thee Stallion Savage in the style of Eminem, and the style of Ariana Grande, and the style of Celine Dion. And I think if Celine heard that, you know, she could just elevate her to where she needs to be.
Super cool.
And just like meeting these people by happenstance. I mean, I dropped my first studio single, Higher, on SoundCloud and a bunch of different platforms. And Shuba just messaged me like, yo, I love your voice. Like, you know, can we work together in some capacity? And I messaged back like, how do I know that you're not a bot on SoundCloud? And she was like, meet me in person. And I was like, okay, this sounds sketchy, but all right, let's do it. And we met, and she's like, yeah, anything that you need musically, let's do that. And she ended up, we recorded like 4 songs in our first studio session together that are split between these different projects. And I think that it'll be great. And she's just one of the artists. So, there's another one, Duran Bernard, awesome, who sang with like Erykah Badu for 10 plus years. And, he's in the process of, you know, remixing one of my songs. And I think we'll probably make it the official version because he's just that good. So. I can't wait.
Amazing. So you're having kind of like synchronous aspects to the creation process where you're hitting people in interesting ways. That's so
cool. You need to have like cool friends that are good at what they do, that want to collaborate. And if you have that, cool stuff will get made. That's amazing.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, the producers on these projects are like out of this world. I mean, so the cover art that's, you know, behind me is actually one of the cover arts from the projects. And the guy who produced like the majority of that, his name is Matt Sterling. he's relatively new to producing. I think he's probably been producing for under 2 years, if that. And I mean, the stuff that he's putting out now is just like, are you sure you've only been doing this for 2 years? Because it's, you know, it sounds like people that have been working on this for 12 years, like 20 years. And then the other guy, Chris Bivens, he's worked with a ton of people from Chica, who's been on like, you know, Late Shows, and Kehlani, and, you know, Hank, you know, like veterans in the R&B field. And it's just like, I'm blessed that they're just supplying me with a constant stream of like music to record to. And I actually just finished setting up my home studio like probably 3 a.m. So it's just like, now I'm finally getting back to my roots after being stuck in quarantine and not being able to hit the studio since February. Just made me realize that I need to.
Gotta have a reliable home studio, especially now.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So for your music, are you you're mainly working with producers then, who are kind of making a lot of the beats, and you're singing? Are you adding any other instrumentation, or mainly just singing? Or
So I mean, for my first projects, I started off, it was like 33%, so like a third of the music I was writing or producing myself, and then Matt and Chris are producing the other two-thirds respectively. So now it's more that one LP is produced almost entirely by Matt, and the other one's produced almost entirely by Chris. And then I take them, and if there's anything that needs to be added to them, then I'll add that production in myself and instrumentation. Nice. And then in terms of songwriting, that's all me. I couldn't really wrap my head around people writing songs for me, because it's just like, you know, these are like my emotions and thoughts flushing out. And maybe I'll get to that point where hopefully, you know, I'm hitting stardom and I'm like, too many things to do, I can't write anymore. And, you know, maybe that'll be the case one day. But for now, it's just, I write songs on the fly, you know. I'll be working out and I'll write a song.
Do you like, when you're writing, do you like to sit down at a piano, or what's your approach?
I can write anywhere. I mean, one of my most popular songs, Higher, actually wrote that at the gym. And I had like no music or anything, no instruments, no equipment or anything with me. I was in the middle of a set, and I was listening to some stuff that I recorded earlier in the week at the studio on SoundCloud. And SoundCloud does this thing that I still hate to this day, that after your music playlist is done, they'll play somebody else's random music, and you're like, what is this? So like 20 seconds of the song played, and I was like, nah, and I skipped it. But then some lyrics started writing themselves in my head to that random instrumental that I played on SoundCloud. So I was like, actually, let me go back to that. And within 15, 20 minutes, the full song was written, melodies, you know, cadence, tone, everything was written. And I just had to bring up my phone, and I was like, all right, cool. I wrote it all down to Evernote. And then I messaged that producer, who turned out to be Chris. And I was like, I want that instrumental. I need that. And he's like, yeah, sure, take it. I don't really care about that instrumental that's on the back burner. Like, do what you want with it. And I was like, all right, cool. And I think I got it for like a couple of dollars, you know, looking back. And he's like, all right, yeah, like, let's see what you can do with it. And I dropped it, and the next thing you know, like, OVO Sound is calling us, both of us. And he's like, yo, I just got a call from Majid Jordan at OVO. Like, what did you do on that track? And he's like, I'm like, you know, listen to it. And he's like, I had no idea that you're going to, like, you know, record or throw down that way on the track. And he's just like, whatever you need, is I'll provide. And I was like, that is the best thing I heard all year.
That's so cool.
Thank you.
What a cool story.
That randomized algorithm had a big impact on your creative
destiny. It really did. For the first time and only. true.
That's funny. I like how your parents must have been super encouraging throughout your creative endeavors as well, because, like, I feel like a lot of parents would be like, don't you think, like, you're good? Like, you know, like, be like, yeah, neuroscience, linguistics, biology. Like, maybe you don't need to be making records, Jason.
Yeah, I mean, that was my dad's perspective for the longest time. He was just like, I got out of college and, you know, got my neuroscience, my linguistics, and all these different, you know, backgrounds and fields under my belt. And he's like, so, you know, what's your move? What job are you going to get? And I'm like, no, I'm hitting the studio, you know, tomorrow and next week, and I'm recording these projects. And he's like, you're not trying to use your degrees? And I'm like, I am, in, you know, a very creative way. And he's like, well, the police department hiring. I was like, no, I just, neuroscience and biology, you want me to go out there and put on a vest and run around in the streets? No, thank you.
Get you a job, Jason.
Right. No. They're not saying that now.
Good. You've also, that's super cool, and happy to promote the records when they come out. I know it sounds like you're still kind of making the final touches or final moves on what those releases look like. So good luck with all that.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to talk a little bit too about your startup, but before we jump into that, NASA is most people are familiar with. How did you get involved with NASA? What's the work that you did with them?
So it was kind of again by happenstance, and it's just applying myself and seeing what happens, what comes of it. I don't even know what I was doing one day. I was probably just combing through opportunities on my computer, one of those deep dives, and I just came across this opportunity that said like NASA is hiring, looking for, people to work with them. And I'm like, okay, I have a neuroscience background. That can't be too different from astrophysics, right? No, it is. but I'm like, let me apply and see what happens. And they're just like, we're looking for people to come out and see this launch. We're partnering with SpaceX, we're doing the Falcon 9 launch and we're doing a bunch of different things. Social media wise, and we want people to have like extensive reach to partner with us and kind of introduce the topics of space and just exploration into those communities, and then we'll do the same for them, like we'll put you on our platforms and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, this sounds like kind of social and less technical, and I was like, I can get with that. So I applied, and it was like, hey, how much reach do you have? Why are you applying? What can this program do for your community? What can you do for us? Type thing. And I'm like, okay, type a bunch of stuff out, and I sent it off. And then a couple of days later, I get an email saying, you've been waitlisted. And I was like, all right, that's something. Waitlist from NASA is not the worst thing in the world. And I think a few hours later, they said, hey, Jason, we had a ton of, really great applicants, and the selection process is really hard and tough, and we try our best to consider everyone. And I was like, oh, when a letter starts off like this, I already know that I didn't get it. And they're like, unfortunately we had to decline you and, go with other more suited individuals. And I was like, okay. And then like 5 minutes later, they're like, actually, no, we sent that email to you in error. We're so sorry. And I was like, what? They're like, actually, we accepted you. And I was like, oh. So a roller coaster of like literally every response I could have gotten, waitlist decline, except I got it all from them.
You think NASA would be a little more detail oriented?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, I thought so. I'm like, how's this launch gonna go?
Didn't expect the sloppiness on the waitlist outreach.
True, no, they actually did. They did because of rain, so they did waitlist it. You're right.
Ah, well, there you go.
That's so cool. Yeah, what was that process like? I mean, did you go to the launch and like share that with like the community? What does that mean, or like how did that happen?
Yeah, so I was actually trying to coordinate because I had just come off the release of my EP, and I was like, maybe if I could bring a film crew to the space station, or not like the space station out there, but like the, the headquarters, maybe we can shoot like some type of really sciencey music video for Higher, because, this song is called Higher. I'm like, it kind of goes in line with, space, and just having a rocket launch and a music video is something that like, I feel like, exactly, no artist.
It's an excellent production value there.
Oh yeah. And I'm like, as long as our cameras don't like waste away by the fumes or anything.
How much did he pay for that?
I'm broke internally. I really tried to, but they were like, no, we can only give government clearance to so many individuals, and unfortunately you cannot bring a crew down here. It's just you that has the clearance. And I was like, all right, so The worst thing about it is I actually got stuck in the airport that day of the launch in Chicago. And, I was on like the first flight out of going to Orlando, and I'm like, all right, cool. I was there like a couple hours early, and I ended up being there for like 5, 6, 7 more hours. And that plane that I was supposed to be on had some technical difficulties. They're like, we got to change a tire, we got to do this and that. And I'm like, didn't know planes needed tire changes, but this is not the day for that. So I'm like emailing NASA like, hey, like, can you delay the launch for me? And they're like, no. Who are you? Son. And I was like, Exactly. So I'm just like, so sadly, I missed that launch in person. I did get to see it online and, you know, be a part of it. And I'm still connected with the community. Like, you know, talking to astronauts on Facebook is like something that I could do in my spare time. But wild. I hope to, once COVID is over, get down there and then actually film a video for hire. I'm like still reserving that for NASA, and actually they did approve the video. They're like, that'd be cool if you could just bring a camera yourself. So I actually just purchased a camera.
Nice.
A couple days ago. So I'm like,
you're in maybe with the marketing people there.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And I'm like, hey, I'll put this video out, and I feel like it'll reach like millions, and you know, NASA will, and SpaceX will be like on top forever after that. Like, the cool.
Yeah, you ever. Need me.
Yeah,
guys.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you need me.
Let's be clear here.
I love it. Well, I appreciate your, like, I think the curiosity is one word there, but also just like the openness of like seeing how it'll unravel. Like, I think you just, maybe it's because of your track record also, and like, you know, having a few universities worth of degrees and being successful musically very early, like, it's like, I think it feels like a state of mind almost that you're kind of operating in, where you're like, well, I, you know, this could very well go well also. You know, I think most people, we just, like, human beings and the human condition is just like, this is not going to work
out
for me.
Yeah.
And this is not going to happen, and da, da, da. And like, you know, it's, it seems like your own experience has kind of disproven those kinds of mental blocks that, prevent a lot of other people from moving forward.
I would agree. I mean, I think that a lot of people would be astonished that, you know, a 16-year-old from the south side of Chicago made it across the world to, you know, the University of Cambridge to study international relations. You know, that just is something that is unheard of. Or, I mean, because it's just like growing up, going to high school, first of all, in one of the most dangerous neighborhoods in Chicago, like Inglewood, where, you know, at the time there was like this weird rate, like 1 in 6 chance that you would not like be injured, you know, or, you know, seriously harmed during your time there. And I was just like, okay, so I'm entering this field or this space every day for 4 years continuously. What are the odds if that 1 in 6 is just, you know, for a day, you know, that it's going to happen to me? I feel like it's 1 in 1. And fortunately for me, it did not happen. Fortunately, I was able to go from that high school right around the corner to Hyde Park to, you know, one of the best universities in Chicago, really in the U.S. And then, you know, to Philly. And it's just like, these are things that are limitations that people, I guess really are circumstantially, you know, people from that zip code are not, you know, likely to go and have these exposure to these big opportunities, these life-changing opportunities. And even more so, it's just people in general. I mean, this is extremely selective, but I think that if you keep an open mind, I think that the universe works things out in ways that are unexpected and unprecedented for you to just kind of defy records and set your own. And I think that it is a lifestyle, it is a mindset, just being open. Absolutely. And not doubting things before they even happen. It's just like, I don't doubt anything, you know, anymore. And I think that that's probably a huge lend to my success. It's just, if I apply for something, in my head I'm thinking, yeah, I'm going to get it, and this is what I'm going to do after that, and this is what I'm going to do next, like 4 or 5 steps down the line. And if it doesn't work out, then I just reorient. But I just, you got to keep moving like 10 steps ahead.
Yeah, just staying open, listening to the universe, and following the energy. I love it.
That's very inspiring to hear.
Yeah, listen closely, everyone. Rewind that, you know, that's really useful, practical stuff. You mentioned the south side of Chicago and the difficulties in that area. I mean, you know, your bio touches on this a little bit as far as you being an advocate for underserved communities. I mean, you must feel a sense of kind of almost like moral obligation or ethical obligation to be, you know, an inspiring figure, you know, to especially young people who don't imagine themselves. You know, I think adults, we have everybody, you know, adults are one thing, but like for the kids that come up completely, in an area like that.
I agree. Yeah. If from an early age you're told you can't do this, you can't do that, then that type of mindset that we just discussed is not like an ideal, you know, mindset. It's not even feasible because you've been shown that that's not going to work out for you. Don't even think like that. Oh, you could never get that opportunity. You can't drive a car like that. I mean, that's a materialistic view, but it's just like goals that are attainable, that's, you know, don't even set for yourself, you know? And I think that having a visual representation, and even more so having a personal connection to someone that is a representation of that, like, just shows like, yeah, you can do that. I mean, I was out at a, I think this is like maybe a year, maybe in 2019, like after I got the NASA thing, I was out with friends at like a bar in Chicago on the North Side. And my friend was like, yo, you just got accepted to like NASA, like this program is like huge. And he's like going on about it as we're in like the line to like pay our cover fee to get into the bar. And people are like, nah, they're like, they're messing around. And then like some girl walks up like, oh my God, like, is he serious about like you being with NASA? I was like, yeah. Like, and she's like, oh, like I work for BET. And I was like, oh, well, there you go. Like, let's talk. Just like just random occurrences. And it's just, you know, I don't know, just people talking about it in an inspiring way and showing people that there is more to do. And he's also an artist himself. So it's just like, yeah, like once I get more of myself and my future, my success established, then I'm going to definitely try to, you know, build programs in my own communities that allow people to experience the same things that I've experienced. Because I think it's only fair, you know, it's so many things have been done wrong historically to especially the South Side of Chicago and residents therein, that, you know, there needs to be some sort of reparations, if you will. And if that has to come from an internal factor of the community, then it's just like, so be it, you know, it's got to be done for the kids at least.
Yeah. Yeah. We're a podcast of three white men, but we're aware. we did a social action episode a few ago, you know, kind of going with the current racial movement for, you know, combating injustice and inequality in America. You know, it's, you know, troublesome in some ways, but it's also, you know, for some people to, I think, have to like come to this awareness or come to this realization, the fact that it has to take place is unfortunate, but it's so overall, like it's so damn useful for the country right now to have this moment of contemplation and reflection and say like, wow, the history in the past ain't so good. And, you know, it seems like a lot of white Americans are, you know, having a moment of reflection and contemplation, hopefully, and, you know, try to undo the systemic fucked up injustices that have been perpetuated against people of color. And, you know, I think Chicago is no exception. So hopefully
Chicago has some of the,
we can make some damn momentum.
Yeah, exactly.
I feel like Chicago is, they're like, oh, it's like this big city and, you know, second city and whatnot. And but you come to Chicago or you live here and you see how segregated it is. You know, there's a little country, you know, everywhere. There's little Italy, little Vietnam, little, you know, Chinatown. There's, you know, Pilsen, you know, or I guess La Barra. It's just like so many different places that you can go, but you have to know how to survive and exist in those places. But I don't know. I mean, it's just the history is prevalent. You can see the separation there. And you can see that since inception, you know, it's not been fair. So it's just, I think this wake up call was necessary to have this moment. I think that this is a very powerful moment that, you know, we kind of all hold up in quarantine to ourselves, and we only have our thoughts with us, you know, besides family members and little ones.
It seems to have amplified the anger because, you know, George Floyd's murder was so just disgusting and brutalizing and terrible. And these other, you know, victims and intentional, and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery, and, you know, the list goes on. But I think particularly, you know, this moment right now in America and really world history, because it's the guys in Europe or, you know, they're throwing the slaver statues in the bay in Bristol, England. Like, you know, it seems to be a very interesting kind of awakening moment for everyone. And I think it's clearly related to, you know, the stir craziness has amplified that.
Oh yeah. I mean, I got in my DMs and on Instagram, one of my friends who lives in Portugal was like, yo, check out this song. Like, one of my friends from Portugal made this song. It's for like the Black Lives Matter movement. And I'm like, wait a minute, in Portugal, like, this started pretty much here, sick. You know, in this city, you know, saying, and how did it get all over there? And you feel so personally inclined to make a song, you know, it must have resonated, you know, so deep into the earth's core that it was felt on the other side, you know. So I think that we're changing the landscape.
One of your songs was on a Portugal BLM. Yeah, yeah.
That's oh, no, it was them that wrote a song from Portugal about BLM. And I was like, that's, you know, and they weren't even, it wasn't even a black artist.
That's beautiful.
Like,
that's
just,
worldwide.
Yeah, I made a film about Palestine for the couple of years. You and I talked about that a little bit, but Gaza in particular is similarly persecuted by the state of Israel.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of solidarity. And Angela Davis actually wrote in her book, Freedom is a Constant Struggle. She compares the movement in Ferguson, Missouri, after Michael Brown's death to Palestinian uprisings in the West Bank and Gaza. And, you know, there's a lot of camaraderie and solidarity between kind of, you know, persecuted people of color worldwide. It's you know, I think the struggle is united among everyone that is experiencing it. And there's, I think the momentum grows through that connection.
I think so.
Yeah, Jason, I'm so fascinated by your story. It's so cool to see what you're doing and kind of where you come from. I lived in Chicago for 4 years. Scott lives there now, and I know how, like, how difficult that is. I mean, I can't imagine growing up as a black youth on the south side of Chicago and in those areas. And you just, like, you seem like you have kind of figured it out in a way. Like, you just are so positive and optimistic, and you're just kind of staying open and letting the universe take control and guide you wherever it takes you. And I'm wondering, did that come from your parents, that kind of optimism of, like, you can do, you know, anything you want to do, or is it something you developed on your own? And
how does
that relate to, like, your peers too? I mean, growing up, was that mentality something that was prevalent even amongst your peers, or was it the opposite of that? Or
I would say that my mindset was probably unique amongst my peers growing up, and probably because, you know, my parents are entrepreneurs. You know, they built their own paths. Like, my mom put herself through high school and college, you know, on her own dime, basically, because she had to work from an early age. Her parents, or I guess her father, died when she was 17, and you know, even when he was alive, he was only making like a janitor's salary. So it was just, you know, from time, you know, immemorial, basically, she had to raise her own funds to fund her own education and make her own opportunities happen for her. So that's just sort of like that starter mindset that was, you know, put into me before I was even, you know, on the earth. It was just kind of something that's in my DNA. And I mean, my dad, like I said, he wanted me to be a police officer, but that's definitely not, you know, accepted or not kosher in this climate. But it's because he was himself a police officer for 30 years. And then, you know, on the other side, in the art side, he had like a limousine business and stuff like that. So it's just like he was connected to a professional and also the art and creative side of Chicago. I mean, I remember this t-shirt that I would wear when I was a kid that said, you know, carpenter, you know, that you could make anything. And then there's another one that was just like, I can be whatever I set myself to be, or whatever I choose, whatever path that I want, I can create for myself. And it was just like t-shirts like that, that I can remember that I would wear when I was like 2 or 3. But like, I would look at those and I would look at myself wearing those in the mirror and be like, you know, this little animal on the shirt, it could be me, you know, saying, like, it's a carpenter. I could be a carpenter. And I think that these words can apply to me since I'm wearing the shirt. I think the subliminal messaging really has a strong part to play in forming your early opinions of yourself and where you can go and how you shape your destiny. So,
Super cool. And that's actually a perfect transition into your work with the, you know, social emotional learning. We talked about emotional intelligence, which is Dan Goleman's kind of groundbreaking work in modern psychology and how, you know, behaviors are tied to emotions and, you know, the psychological component behind that. How, you know, are you implementing kind of some of what you were just talking about in your work with the startup, and you know, how does that apply to some of those emotional learning
Yeah, for sure.
Tools.
I think that, first of all, I think that I apply, like, you know, concepts that are prevalent in neuroscience, psychology, like all these different, you know, behavioral sciences fields. I'm applying that into my music, one. And I think that it helps people to process their own emotions because, you know, they hear that, they hear what I'm saying, and they're like, oh, interesting. But they don't know that it's been processed through, like, an academic mindset as well as a creative and, you know, kind of cathartic mindset, too. It's just like, yeah, this is great to get out, but then I also, like, form the lyrics in a way that are in line with, like, actual leading, you know, ideologies.
I'm pretty obsessed with, like, lines, by the way.
Yeah,
I really like lines a lot, and it makes me very happy. And so now I realize that I've been manipulated neurologically.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm sorry to tell you. I mean, if you listen to Glass Animals, you've been manipulated twice. Because the lead singer of Glass Animals is also a neuroscientist. And I think that, you know, there's like crosstalk of like the arts and sciences. Yeah, Gooey. I love that song. I love that song. The production value is just unmatched there. But yeah, I mean, just like, I don't know. And then like transitioning that into a startup. And the startup, by the way, is called Strut Learning. And yeah, we create emotional intelligence technology and social emotional learning technology. And we try to like build that into the curriculum for kids as early as like, you know, third graders and even the students of life. I call them, you know, adults. Because I think that anyone can benefit from being emotionally savvy. Because that it's not taught in schools. There's no course that says, okay, here's how to manage your emotions. It's like, here's how to like study psychology. And then people try to use that and like be like, oh yeah, I am the master of my emotions and yours. And I can diagnose you because I'm a psychologist. And it's like, no, you took one course. and I think that emotional intelligence and other types of intelligence kind of dictate that, you know, standard academic intelligence and bodies of knowledge don't translate well into social spheres all the time.
Yeah, I'd like to know even a little more. I appreciate that background too, but you know, I think from a pandemic virtualization perspective, you know, there's been rumblings like Khan Academy was like really changed a lot of education online initially. If people aren't familiar, Khan Academy was like he was making math formula equations on video for his nephews across the country. And like, that's how Khan Academy started. And like, it's now this massive, you know, it's just like an online learning like academy thing, library, right? Resources.
Yeah. I spend a lot of time on there with my tutoring kids for tutoring. they're on there all day.
On Khan Academy. That's perfect. That's beautiful. Yeah. And so that was an early one. And then, now there's so many, that are kind of proliferating in this space. And I think the pandemic has, you know, accelerated this also when it comes to the virtualization. And I think we're due. Like I would say also American society in particular, I don't want to speak for other countries, but it's probably true. Scandinavia seems to be ahead of the curve there, but most, you know, world civilization, like education format is very 20th century. It's very like factory assemble, like be a good factory worker, regurgitate the information and do it on timely and be well behaved and off you go. And like, well, no, like someone like Jason was miserable in that environment. You know, we're not encouraging kids and the youth to, you know, transcend that or go beyond themselves. It's very confining, basically, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, no. And it's all compliance based.
Yeah, and so it must be a cool opportunity to help transform it with this company.
Yeah, I mean, I think personally, I was miserable, like you said, in high school. I mean, I finished the curriculum by sophomore year, and when I originally got to the high school, there were two principals there, and one was like, "Wow, sorry, test scores, like you were college level at sixth grade. You're probably done here in like 1 year, 2 years tops, and then we can send you on to college." And I was like, "Yeah, awesome." And then the other one was like, "I don't know about that. Maybe 3.5 years. I don't know about 2 years. You know, that's just too little time." So luckily enough, the principal who thought about the 2 years mindset transferred to another campus and became the principal there. And I was stuck with the, "Oh yeah, no, 3.5 years is going to work for you guys." And he was actually like, "You know what, now that he's gone, you're going to stay the whole 4 years." And I'm like, Okay, so
I remember you saying that there was like some bureaucracy in the level of you getting out, and yeah,
and it's just like
getting out like a prison.
Kind of. It felt like it, because I mean, just to paint a picture, this is a high school on the south side of Chicago in Englewood. The security guards are actually Chicago police officers, so it's just like there's this aspect of authoritarianism, and it's just like, you know, you make one mistake, you have one disagreement with a classmate, and it's not like detention, it's not in school suspension. There's this threat of like this larger systemic issue in the school at all times, and I think that was something that I didn't even realize because I was looking at it through the lens that my father was one of these guys. So I think that I'm protected by this institution, but you get older and you realize these are the same institutions that have been present since, you know, 1649, and it's just like, you know, this just nothing has changed. And if to have it introduced into a school shows these kids that there are no second chances. And I think, I mean, yeah, going back to like my curriculum, I was walking around the hallways for 2 years. Literally, I had nothing to do on my schedule. The only thing on my schedule was lunch at fourth period, and it was fourth or fifth. You know, I would sometimes try to go to lunch twice because I'm just like, I have nothing else to do. I might as well eat. And then history, I had no other classes for 2 years. So I had to make my own schedule. I would go to the community college, Kennedy King. I would go to UChicago starting at like 13 and take classes there. And that's kind of how I started studying at these different campuses. Because like, I have nothing else to do. And the security guards that were new would be like, hey, why are you not in class? Like, you got to get to class. And I'm like, what class? And they're like, oh, stop trying to play smart with me, blah, blah, blah. You need to be in class. Let me see your schedule. And I'm like, okay, I put my schedule out on my blazer and I unfold it. And I'm like, here. And they look at it and they're like, is this a joke? And I'm like, how could I make my own schedule? Like, you know, that's not a joke. It's like, it's blank. And I'm like, yeah, it's blank. I have nothing to do 7 days or 4 or 5 days a week. And, you know, I'm just chilling. And he's like, wow. Well, you can't just walk the hallways. Do you want to go to the computer lab? I'm like, I guess. I don't know what else to do. So, yeah, I'll be on Khan Academy just, like, trying to teach myself calculus in, like, 13, 14. Like, wow. Hardest stuff in the world to do, but, you know, trying not to be bored. But, yeah.
You're the like, perfect example for why the current state of education is
does not work.
Outdated and irrelevant.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're trying to, like, build it so that students can learn at their own pace and also at their own level of emotional intelligence, because if you're getting frustrated with the lessons that are being presented to you because they are rote, they are memorization, they are routine, they're, you know, factory assembly, you know, mindset. And it's like, this happened in 1776 and then this happened in 1812. And it's like, no, what year is supposed to happen? And you're like, 1812. And they're like, okay, you get an A, like, good job. You can now run a company. And it's like, okay. Right. if you're frustrated with that and, you know, you're not learning anything new, you're not being persistent with anything that can, you know, challenge your growth, then, you know, you're not going to want to sit still for, you know, 5-6 hours a day and try to absorb that information. But maybe if it's being presented to you in a way that is in line with how you think and how you process things, then maybe it'll just benefit you a little bit more. And if we can, you know, change for the better 5-10% of the education system, then that will make 5-10% of America better, you know, and then hopefully other countries will adopt it too. And it'd just be a better world.
Incremental. You know, yeah. Incremental growth, hopefully. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Appreciate your work on that.
Yeah. I love your passion for kind of teaching and education too. I mean, that's a huge passion of mine as well. And I think all of us here, you know, it's so cool for you to be taking what you've learned and just wanting to like give back and help people. I think that's like my favorite part about education in general is just passing on knowledge. Right. I'm really curious about your kind of work with emotional intelligence. Where did that start for you? Was there a particular book or person that kind of started you on that topic? And then do you have any kind of current favorite books or authors or speakers, just kind of like resources for you about emotional intelligence?
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, I think it really started in college when I was studying cognitive neuroscience, because a lot of that was based in linguistics, which doesn't sound like it would be about emotional intelligence. But then you talk about, I had one linguistics course that was about child development and, you know, how children learn languages and stuff like that, and how it's tied a lot to behavior and how it's tied a lot to intrinsic motivation to learn and just, you know, sort of fit in and adapt. You know, it's just like, oh, wow, you know, children hear a million words by the time they're one. So it's just like, how do those words affect how they think and how they right. speak, you know? And then going on to, you know, classes like judgment and decisions, like how do humans make the decisions that they make? You know, is it to benefit just themselves? Is it to benefit the world, people that they care about that are close to, or people that they've never seen or will never meet? How are those transactions formed? I read a lot in college and I read a lot in high school. These days, I'm not really reading much literature in terms of academics. It's more so looking around you and seeing how things are working, how systems are working now, and trying to evolve those. I think the big problem is that these systems are profitable for institutions and that they don't want to change them into something that will be less profitable or look less like right. Monetization for them. Even if it would benefit society down the line, 5-10 years, they want what's making money now. Not yep. to take it into like an anti-capitalist point of view, but it's just like,
here we are.
Very true, though.
That's what you gotta face.
I mean, that's an issue literally across the board in the United States, and I'm in other yeah. capitalist countries too. But how everything that feels like oftentimes the things that we try to do to like help ourselves is some way somehow going to be monetized, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then it just kind of taints it, and it makes it really difficult to actually make change, you know?
It does. It does. And if you don't have the capital, then you're sitting here like, I've got all these ideas, and I really want to get these out to the masses, but, you know, let me go work a 9-to-5 to make that happen. And then you've lost 5-10 years of your life, and you're like, I haven't made any headway on that thing I was trying to do. And then you're disheartened, you know, disenfranchised, just like yeah. the rest of America.
Not Jason Ivey, though.
I'm trying not to let that happen.
Wish I had had more emotional intelligence in my like education process, and yeah, I'd be curious to hear like a little more about like the curriculum you do for that, because that's interesting, like combining that with like a technology. I assume it's like a website or an app that kids use, or how does that work?
I could talk a little bit about that. So if you go to learn2strut.com or even just like eq123.com, you can actually take a diagnostic assessment and sort of see how you score emotionally. And I like to compare it to something like the Myers-Briggs assessment, just because people are so familiar with that. Like, they can rattle off like what their four letters are. And I think there's like a dash extension now.
ENFP.
I think I'm like ENTP. A, okay. All right. I'm ENTP. ENTP A.
My wife's an INFJ. And so
INFJ. Okay.
We know all about that. Yeah, yeah.
That the scientist,
the INFJ is like the withdrawn, like calculating sounds like the wrong word.
Yep.
Because it sounds negative, I think that is, but yeah. I think I'm like scientist. I'm the extrovert, like just like spontaneous, like, and she's like rational, logistical, and they're a good match, you know. So
yeah,
makes
yeah.
a lot of sense.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, so if you log onto that, it's free to take. I'm not trying to like market it or anything or, you know, plug it in, but it's just like, that is something that we broke down into five. It's like the Cassell model of five different competencies. We added a sixth, and then we multiplied that by three to break it down into even further, you know, detailed subcompetencies. So you can track your growth and your current assessment, first of all, in real time. So you take that first assessment, we're trying to cut it down to something manageable, so it's not like 500 questions and you're sitting there for like a day trying to figure out who you are and you're having this midlife crisis, you know, by taking this test. We
faster,
to...
I need it faster.
Yeah. You can't yeah, make it through be like... because you've lost it.
True. It's something like 50 or 60 questions, and I think that can be done in like, you know, half an hour maybe. And then from there, you get a score. And you see what your strongest emotional intelligence points are, and also the points that we can work. We don't want to say weakest. And then you can take it again as many times as you want to, and it'll also give you tips on how to, you know, go through life and how to apply, you know, foster those and to make them your stronger points.
Yeah.
So that's the basis for. Amazing. Thank you. That's the basis for what we're doing in terms of like for the community. That's something that's free. That's going to be free forever. It's a diagnostic tool. that you can access without, you know, having to pay anything for. And it's not one of those that it's like you take the test and then it's like, oh, to get your results, now pay us $10 to see this. Like, no. That's, I hate those types of websites.
Yeah.
But now we're building an app, an application that'll be AI based, and it'll, like, you know, cater itself to each student's individual needs, and it'll track your progress throughout your lesson and see, okay, like, how are you feeling now? How are you feeling about this subject matter? Do you need a break? And then it'll learn that over time and be like, okay, after 20 minutes, you'll need like a 5-minute break. Then you want to dive back into what you were focusing on, or then you want to start on a new topic and then, you know, kind of work that around into the first topic. And I think that that type of learning is a lot more beneficial. I think that there are learning specialists out there, like at Penn. When I was struggling with these classes, you know, I was taking the most advanced classes I could take there. I took, you know, PhD level artificial intelligence courses, and I had to go to advisors like, how do I study this material because it's so dense? Like, reading two sentences of this stuff is like driving me mad. I can't even process what this guy is trying to say about, am I a computer? Like, what are they talking about? And, you know, this one woman was like, okay, so humans actually learn better in chunks. So if you're taking an hour to study, then you're actually only going to be productive for 40 minutes out of that hour. And you're going to need 20 minutes of downtime to start to consolidate that information and into, you know, something that can be usable later. And like, why are no professors talking about this anywhere? You know, why did I have to come to you and make an appointment and wait a week to see you for you to tell me this, like, a very useful piece of, like, information that I could take with me through college and the rest of my life? So now I'm like, okay, cool. Right. I can, like, study better, you know. And first of all, and since everything is metrics based and how are you performing, that's going to, you know, lead me to being a better student in terms of, you know, academics. So I could be like, okay, yeah, let me set a 40-minute timer and just read as much as I can and take a 20-minute break. And then, you know, go do something else for a minute and let that information sort of sink in. And I think that that's what this program is sort of built to do. It's just, how do you learn as an individual versus what do we think you'll learn, you know, or how do we think you'll learn? And, you know, prescriptive versus descriptive, that old argument. So
I love it. Like, the customization aspect too. Two quick things about that. My dad has worked with the Simmons Personal Survey for a while, if you're familiar with that at all. It's also similar to the MB Myers-Briggs. So I'm pretty familiar. I think it is based off of emotional intelligence. Dan Goleman is kind of the guy who wrote emotional intelligence, I want to say 92, early 90s, something like that. New York Times bestseller about this stuff. And that material contributed to Search Inside Yourself. We talked to our guest last week was Miru Kim, who is a friend of mine, a coworker at Facebook. She is also a facilitator for Search Inside Yourself Leadership Institute, which SIY uses. Basically, they use mindfulness, emotional intelligence, and neuroscience, and all three of those overlap. So, you know, relevant to Jason and your many disciplines. But I think that information is super valuable, and you know, I think it also creates self-awareness in a lack of which is such an obstacle, right? You know, you can't absorb information. Well, why is that? Well, this is actually a, you know, way to help us unravel some of those questions about our abilities and capacities to succeed. So super useful.
Yeah.
I know we're,
it's awesome.
Oh, did you want to say something, Ryan?
Yeah. I just wanted to kind of transition a little bit. What I've been curious about this entire time is just kind of what your spiritual practice looks like, Jason, and kind of if I hear a lot of the language that you're using, it to me, it aligns with a lot of, you know, my philosophies, and kind of feels like you're really just optimistic and really open and just letting the universe kind of take you where it takes you and trying to not fight it and just flow with it as much as possible. And to me, it's a very spiritual approach, a very spiritual practice. And I'm wondering what you would consider your spiritual practice to look like. And if there was any influence, you know, from your childhood, or if it's something that's developed later in life, and just kind of maybe what you feel on that.
So I think you sort of hinted at that question earlier when you were asking where did that mindset, where did that ideology and belief come from? And I had a feeling you're gonna, you know, double back to that because I didn't quite answer it before. But I think I started off sort of like a, you know, Christian household, just because my parents were, my mom was like raised Lutheran. She went to a Lutheran school. My dad, it was always in the Catholic churches. And I think that that's something that's prevalent in, you know, communities of color, because, you know, faith is such a driving force to get you through like these obstacles that, you know, people face on a day to day. But then I realized that even these faith-based communities are extremely prescriptive. They're like, you gotta do this. You have to do this this way. You have to be on church at a church like every Sunday. And, you know, you've got to come Wednesday too, if you want to, you know, even extra favor from God. And it's just like, I don't think that's how it works, you know, quite honestly. And it got to the point where my younger brother was trying to get into this high school, which will remain unnamed, but it's in the Chicago suburban area. And the principal was like, okay, mom, brother, nice to meet you. It's good to see that he has, you know, a family support. And we're like, well, what does that mean? And then he's like, okay, but are you religious? And we're like, yeah, you know, we consider ourselves to be Christian. And he's like, okay, so are you going to church? And my mom's like, well, I really try to, you know, I try to practice it more than I, you know, attend church. You know, I try to practice it every day. And she's the type of person that if she sees someone in need, she'll go out of her way to help them. Like friends that I've introduced to my mom, she's helped them same day. And, you know, I'm just like, mom, you know, this is my friend, you know, so-and-so. They need somewhere to, you know, stay. They need somewhere to do this. They need a job. And she's like, okay, well, let's see, I have a friend who does this, or, you know, there's this building that I know can take this person, and, or, oh, maybe they can stay with us until they do this and that, or, oh, are you hungry? Let's go grab some food. And it's just like, that's the type of person that she is. So for this principal to be like, are you, you know, can I, if I check your attendance at the church, am I going to see that you're there every Sunday? Wow. And she's like, well, no, you wouldn't, because I try to practice it. Bless you. I try to practice.
That's all the information I need. Thank you.
Yeah, exactly. You know, she's like, I try to practice it in life. You know, I try to be a good Christian. And he's like, well, if you want your son to come here, then you're going to have to go to church every Sunday. And I'm going to need a written letter from that pastor saying that you were there every Sunday.
That's so crazy.
Yeah, that's
yeah. And we were sitting here and he's looking at me like, and what about you, young man? Do you go to church? I'm like, I'm busy, dude. Here. Like, I don't think God is going to hold it against me. You know what I'm saying? If I miss a Sunday,
I'll gonna pray for like, you,
you know,
man.
I don't know you anymore. Right. Yeah. He was just like, no, you're going to have to go
actually,
too.
This conversation makes me want to not go to church.
Yeah. I was like, you know, this is ridiculous. And he's like, you know, we're going to need a letter that you were there every. So we literally had to sign an attendance book and say that we were there every Sunday. And I was like, this is just not what I was looking for in a spiritual practice. So I ended up picking up a bunch of different books about Taoism, about Buddhism, about just different ideologies. And I realized there was a lot of similarity between all these different practices at their core. But then when people get involved, it sort of takes a new life. You know, people are like, oh, okay, actually, if you want to be a good Christian, here's 57 different denominations on how to do that. You know, you can go over there and you can dress like this. You can come over here and you can talk like this and chant that and sing this. And it's just like, but what is that doing for you as a person? What is that doing for society? So personally, I think that introspection is like the best way to, you know, advance yourself, because I mean, someone Absolutely. Preaching at you, and not to say preaching at you or to talk down on like Christian believers, but just someone telling you their personal stories and being like, now apply this to yourself and make that work every week, once a week, and thinking that that's enough is not going to take you anywhere. I mean, it got to the point where my pastor was saying the same stories and I could be like, okay, he's going to talk about football today. And he would, he'd be like, yeah, I was sitting there watching the Super Bowl commercials and thinking to myself, you know, it's a red light. And I'm like, this is not helping me. But
you're,
I think that
you're seeing the card he's pulling.
Oh yeah. I'm like, okay, I think I know your sermon notes by now. I just think that spirituality is sort of like it's not a one size fits all thing. But I think that there are things that can benefit everyone, like meditation, introspection, mindfulness, something that is becoming increasingly popular these days. Mm-hmm. Just being in touch with yourself, and the more in touch with you are with yourself, then the more you can be open to opportunities, just staying positive, you know, just things like that. And I think that in Zen Buddhism and certain lanes of Buddhism, there are practices that are they're challenges to yourself. You know, think on materialism and think on the things that you don't need. Think on the things that you're anchoring yourself to that aren't going to help you in the long run. You know, that car, where is it going to take you after 5, 10 years? It's going to break down. You're going to need a new one. Don't get so attached to that. Don't get so attached to your own body. You know, there are things called the graveyard meditations in Buddhism where it's just like you sit and you stare at a set of corpses for like hours, and then you're just like, no, think about this being you in 100 years, and you're like, oh, that's extremely dark. But then it helps you to elevate to this plane that like people wouldn't get to normally, and you're like, okay, cool, so now I know that the things that I do in life have to like go beyond my body. They have to go beyond just the people that I'm immediately connected to. They have to last a lot longer than I will. There's another one, this happiness challenge, basically. I don't even know what it's called. It's probably a legitimate name, but where monks would sit and try to only think happy thoughts their entire lives, just like nothing negative, not a doubt in their mind, not, you know, oh, it's probably going to rain today, that sucks, then you have to start over, you know, just, and there is one that I saw where this person literally became light, you know, just sort of wasted away, but like in a good way. And I was like, a lot of this stuff sounds dark out of context, but when you realize that we're not going to be here forever as humans, you know, then you have to think, okay, what impact am I having for the people that come next? Even in an educational sphere, you want your people, the following generation, to be better than you. Otherwise, you haven't gone anywhere in life. So it's all about continual and, you know, incremental growth, just hoping for the better for yourself and for the people that come after you. And I think that that's a lot of what my spirituality entails. It's just like, how do I get myself to the highest level possible, like period, for a human being, so that I can be that anchor to like sort of, you know, leverage the rest of my community beyond me. You know, I don't want to be the best person in my community. I don't want to be the best person in my family. I want to be the hallmark, maybe, you know, the blueprint for people to recreate that and then make it better, you know, and supersede me one day. So.
So well said.
Preach. Love it, man. I think Jason Ivey needs to open his own church.
No. That's all cult.
That's the old model.
Right, exactly. That's very outdated of you, Ryan. Just suggest for Jason.
Yeah. That was beautiful, man. That was really great. Thank you for sharing all of that and sharing your views and your approach to that.
Thanks for asking that question. Listening to a polymath describe perennial philosophy and impermanence and the practical application of spirituality, sweet melody to me.
Same.
So thank you. We talk a lot about perennial philosophy and, you know, how they all overlap. And I think that's, that's what set me off years ago, is realizing the connections and the overlap. And it's like all of the stuff that I didn't like was the differences, but all the stuff that I did like, oh, wow, Jesus talks about loving the least of these and praying for, you know, those who persecute you. And Buddha talks about loving kindness and, you know, radical compassion. And, you know, you kind of go down the list, right, of like all these similarities and parallels. And it's a beautiful discovery.
Bob and I are trying to figure out how could more kids be exposed to stuff like this. I wish I knew about it earlier than I did. I kind of found it out on my own in high school, but especially now, it would be incredibly helpful if some more kids were exposed to these perennial philosophies, these things that connect between cultures all around the world. I don't know how, but somehow we gotta get more people into it.
Just plant a seed for Jason.
Please do. I'd love to grow it.
Wonderful. Yeah, thanks again, Ryan, for answering that question, because I was going to ask Jason a kind of a final question, and we wouldn't have got that on the show. Yeah. That would have been a huge travesty. Did you want to add anything else, Jason, before our last formulate question? Because I do know you're a busy guy.
Yeah. So I think that I can answer what books kind of brought me to that plane of spirituality, more so than I can answer what books I could read about or list about emotional intelligence. They were I Ching, or I guess the I Ching was one of the first books that I picked up. Also this book called Christianity Before Christ. And it talks about just the frameworks for Christianity before they even gave it a name. and how they've been in practice and in existence for the longest time. And then I think that there's this website that's just a huge depository of just a ton of different Buddhist meditations and with instructions and images and stuff like that. And if I can remember that, I'll shoot it to one of you all after the show. But yeah, I think that those are like the first three real books. And then there's another book about Taoism that I don't think it had a name. That I read and I was just like, wow, you know, this is great. You know, let me just continue down this path and then try to relate it back to Christianity, try to relate it back to like the Bible, because that's a lot of people in America's talking points. They're like, well, actually the Bible says this. And you're like, oh, okay, well, if you can quote it so well, tell me what it says in this chapter and tell me how you're applying that in your life. And they're like, well, actually, you know, I really only focus on this other book. And it's like, well, then don't talk about the whole book then if you're not a practicing Christian. And they're like, and that breaks people's mindsets. You know, someone was talking about how Black Lives Matter is just this aberration. And they're just like, oh no, like this is not good. You know, like Black Lives Matter, you know, no, all lives matter. And I'm like, okay, well then what about the parable of the sheep in the Bible where Jesus abandoned the 99 sheep to chase after the one that was lost? You know, did he not care about the 99 sheep that he had? Because that's a lot of sheep. Or did he really want that one sheep to be a part of the flock so it can be whole? And then they're like, oh no, I think that one sheep was like the all lives. And I was like, how are you getting that math? Like, this doesn't even sound right.
That's a misread.
Do you know right, they're like, well, let's open through.
Exactly. That's a dodge and deflect.
She's like, it's open to interpretation. I'm like, no, you just did one in.
That one is a particularly good one to bring up right now. The 99 sheep one is I saw it a few weeks ago, and I was like, yes, let's circulate this all over social media.
All over the place. Yeah. Heck yeah, I'm posting that on Facebook like every week.
Yep.
He has some gems. We talked about this. We did a Christianity episode on Easter. We're all Christian upbringing guys that don't go to church regularly. You know, I say that I left the faith really in college, and but you know, kind of to your point, I found it through the East. You know, Hinduism, Buddhism, you didn't Taoism. Leave
faith.
Well, I left the Christian church and institutional Christianity, you know. Yeah, yeah. It's my personal faith, or like I prefer the word trust. You know, whatever. There's a lot of form is not as explanatory of the concept as it ought to be, but I mean, the East is a really beautiful window, I think, especially for, you know, minds like yours. The East, I'm speaking broadly, but, you know, those ideologies as a whole tend to be limitless. You know, they have this capacity of like kind of oneness with all that is, and like this grandiosity to them that, you know, the Abrahamics, you know, no disrespect to, you know, 2 points. Whatever billion religious people that believe, particularly Christian and Islam, you know, there's a lot of believers, and most of those people are great people, and you know, just trying to go to work and raise their kids and buy a sandwich, and you know, it's like it's unfortunate that there's some hypocrisy involved, and there's unfortunate that even more so that there's, you know, extremism and barbarism and abuse and so on, all of which are tied up into some of those institutional aspects. But yeah, My big point would be that as you investigate these systems and kind of see the broader scope and the full spectrum of, you know, what spiritual paths can offer, you know, it's really inspiring. And I think it has a lot of value for contemplating them and investigating them. And, you know, to Jason's point here too, you know, your own self-worth, your own self-value, if you can identify, you know, your own potential and your own future, with you know, kind of that limitlessness aspect, you know, that's a good place to be.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that people should apply that same investigative value, to education, because, and language even, just, you know, just how linguists are, the debate between, oh, prescriptive and descriptive. Okay, you should only talk this way in English. You know, you have to speak you have to say to whom and not to who. And it's just like, well, maybe if that's not serving us anymore, then we should move away from that. And I think that that's the same thing that we should apply to education, that it shouldn't be so prescriptive. You shouldn't have to sit down and write this poem 10 times and then, you know, recite it, because what did you learn from that poem other than the words? Are you learning the meaning behind the words? And I think that it should be, we should move to a more descriptive society that, okay, this is how individuals can learn, this is how individuals can think, process, and feel. And these are the multiple ways in which that can exist. And I think that once we get there as a society, once we get there, even in terms of social justice issues, like, you should act this way and carry yourself this way, and you should not be a certain color, then once you realize, okay, we're all, you know, people, you know, let's just be people in the different ways that people can people, you know, just once we get there as a society, then I think that a lot of the problems that we've placed on ourselves will fall away and rapidly. And I think that we're getting there. I think that this time is a melting pot, for lack of a better word, than for what we're trying to create, the dish that we're trying to see.
Beautiful. Well said. I completely agree. And, you know, I share your similar shreds of optimism, despite, you know, the difficulties in the news and whatever, doom scrolling or whatever. Like, you know, I think you're right. You're right. There is this excitement to, you know, birth pangs kind of is what it is to me. It's like, mm-hmm. this is the difficulty of the transitional phase to, you know, ideally what a fuller, more interconnected civilization is. Mm-hmm. So Jason, thank you so much, man. We have a lot to kind of reflect on over the next few days listening to this, because you've given us a lot of great stuff, and you know, it's just terrific to meet you. Yeah, terrific to meet you and learn more about your mm-hmm. projects.
Thank you.
As far as your music goes, where can people find you? It sounds like on SoundCloud and maybe on Spotify as well.
Yeah, everywhere. SoundCloud, Spotify, Apple Music, Tidal, like Pandora even. Yeah.
Okay, so, great. And under the name Jason Ivy?
Jason Ivy on social media, Jason Ivy, THE Jason Ivy. Yeah, I'm everywhere.
Okay. Awesome.
Jason, come back and talk to us in the future. Give us an update.
Yeah.
I would love to. Yeah. I would love to. I'd love to see how, like, we're all, like, you know, moving through life and where we might be whenever we meet again. Mm-hmm. So.
Absolutely. Yeah, likewise. This is an early episode for us, so it'll be fun to check back in down the line.
Yeah, I love being a part of early stage things, because, you know, it's just like you were there at the beginning, but let's see where this can go. Kind of like Facebook started. And
likewise.
Next time we meet up, it'll be a real nice studio. Just kidding. I don't
know. COVID will be over.
We're in on Jason early. He wasn't in on us early. Awesome. Well, have a good one, man. Thanks so much for joining.
Nice to meet
Thanks,
you, man.
Guys.
You too.
Later.
See you all. Take care.